The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello, and welcome to the second reading of The Sound of Her Voice by Mary Harper. I'm Debbie Robertson. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. In chapters 1, 2, and 3, Mary focused on the early life of her mother's birth, her preschool years with wonderful, playful times with her older sister, and her first years of school, which were increasingly frustrating and finally untenable as Jane's sight diminished more and more. As we ended the book hour, Jane's future promised better times, for in the fall she would be enrolled in a school for the blind. And now we continue with The Sound of Her Voice. Chapter 4, September 1924. Jane paused to look up at the large brick building, squinting as she tried to count the number of stories. "Mother, I think I can see 5 stories. This is so much bigger than my school in Lincolnville." As they climbed to the steps of the Indiana School for the Blind, Jane clutched her mother's hand even tighter and wondered why she had said she wanted to go there. She'd never been in a city, and already the sounds and smells of her new environment threatened to overwhelm her. Arriving in the admissions office, Jane fought back tears as her parents greeted the receptionist and began the paperwork that would allow them to leave her at the school. She stood silently next to Pop while he answered questions about her physical and mental condition, how much sight she had, and her previous schooling. Very few children were completely blind at the school, although all had enough impairment to prevent them from attending regular schools. A polite but businesslike older woman took them on a brief tour of the school, which ended at Jane's new room in the girls' dormitory. 10-year-old Jane would share her room with 4 other girls. She was hoping to meet her new roommates, but the room was empty. The guide showed her where her bed was located, and Pop laid her suitcase on top of it. Jane would get settled later that afternoon, but first she had to say goodbye to her parents. As her parents hugged her, Jane felt a large lump slowly rise in her throat. She tried to swallow and force it back down. Tears formed and overflowed down her cheeks. This was it. They were going home, leaving her to stay in this enormous place with total strangers. She didn't want her parents to know how sad she was. She was afraid they might want to take her back home. Jane watched as her parents disappeared down the hall, her mother turning once for a final wave goodbye. Sniffling and wiping away her tears, Jane walked back to her bed and sat down. She was alone. She wouldn't see her parents again for over 2 months. How would she ever make it that long? Jane had never spent more than 1 night away from home. Now she was stuck in this strange place, missing her sisters and parents. She was tired from this trip and getting hungry. She didn't know what time dinner was served or how to find the dining room. Feeling sorrier for herself by the moment, she sobbed uncontrollably. Passing by Jane's room, another third-grade student, Marie, heard her cries. She recognized the sound of homesick tears and decided to meet the new girl. Knocking on the door, she said, "Hello? Can I come in?" Turning her head to look at the fuzzy shape of a girl in a red dress, Jane wiped her tears with a handkerchief and replied, "Who are you?" "I'm Marie. Aren't you the new girl?" Marie said as she moved toward the sound of Jane's voice. "Yes, my parents just left. My name is Jane. You can sit next to me if you want. We don't seem to have any chairs in here." Jane patted the bed beside her, pleased to have company to distract her. "I know. We only have beds and chests for our clothes. Are you homesick? I got here a couple of days ago, and I'm still homesick. Can you see anything?" "I can see a little, but I can't read print." "Maybe we can be friends," replied Marie. "I'd like that. You're the first one that I've met. Do you like it here?" "It's all right. The teachers are pretty nice, but the governess can be mean unless you follow all the rules." "What's a governess?" She makes sure that you brush your teeth and you go to bed on time. She's sort of like a mother, except she doesn't love you. Mostly, she just tells you what to do. She doesn't sound very nice. Just do what she says and don't talk after lights are out, and you'll be fine. Don't expect to get any hugs from them, even if you're crying because you're homesick. They only care about you making your bed and not causing any trouble. Say, I think it's almost time for dinner. Want to go with me to the dining room? Marie took Jane's hand, and together they walked down the stairs to the dining room. On the way, Marie explained that the girls had their own dining room. Boys had their own down the hall. You don't have to worry about being around any nasty boys. They don't eat with us. They are only in our classes, but they sit on one side and we sit on the other. And we can't talk to each other. We don't even play outside together, explained Marie. I'm glad to hear that, Jane said with relief. Just as they entered the dining room, Jane heard a girl cry out, "There's the new girl!" And she found herself surrounded by several girls who rushed over, enveloping her in a sea of hands that touched her hair, her face, her arms, her dress. What are you doing? Get your hands off me, Jane cried as she backed away, flailing her arms in a futile attempt to stop the violating hands. She instantly flashed back to the henhouse at home when the chickens fluttered at her and flapped their wings in her face. This was even worse, since she was caught off guard. The questions flew. What does she look like? How tall is she? Look at that dress. It's so soft. What color is it? Oh, she has short hair and a bow in it. We're just trying to see what you look like, said Dorothy. Some of us can see a little, but others can't see at all. That's the only way we can know what you look like. You don't have to know what I look like. Don't touch me again, said Jane as she broke away from these new tormentors. Marie grabbed Jane's hand and said, Let's go sit down. I'm sorry they did that to you. That happened to me, too. They do it to all the new girls. Feeling violated and fearful that the other girls would attack her again, Jane hesitated before sitting down with her new friend. Jane, sit with me. They won't bother you now. They're too busy eating. And don't worry, I won't touch you. But it would be nice to know what you look like. She already liked Marie and decided it was safe to describe herself. I'll tell you what I look like, replied Jane. I have blue eyes and short, wavy hair that's hard to comb. I'm wearing a blue and white checked dress. I can still see some print and write a little, but not good enough for public school. That's why I'm here. There was nothing for me at my old school. Now, I want to hear about you. The girls spent the rest of the meal happily talking about their families and previous schools. They were served at their table by disinterested female employees, and Jane found the food to be very plain and bland, not at all the farm fresh food that she was used to at home. She tried not to think about her mother's cooking. Every meal reminded her of what she was missing at home, making the time until Thanksgiving vacation interminable. After lunch, Jane sat on her narrow bed, feeling homesick and lost again. She dabbed a plain white handkerchief at her eyes, trying to wipe away the tears that appeared whenever she thought of her family. She even missed her old school in Lincolnville. At least she knew where everything was and didn't get lost there. She worried about finding her new classroom, if her new teacher would be nice like Miss Starr, and most concerning of all, what the governess would be like. Marie said that though the governesses carried a paddle, they rarely used it. Instead, they often yelled at them and then reported the errant child to the superintendent. Jane shuddered at the possibility of being humiliated by the governess, who would report her to the superintendent, and who, in turn, would tell her parents. She vowed to be perfectly behaved and to follow all the rules. Even though she missed her family terribly, she didn't want to go home. This was her only chance to get an education. She had to stay at school. There was nothing for her to do at home. There was no future for her on the farm. There was a sharp knock on the door, and without waiting for an answer, a tall woman swept into Jane's room. Startled, Jane looked up and through her failing eyes saw the silhouette of a thin woman in a plain dark gray dress, her hair pulled back into a bun. "You must be the new girl. I'm Miss Black, and I'll be your governess. There are some things that you should know about the school and what I'm responsible for. You need to take care of your personal cleanliness. That means you take a bath by yourself every Saturday and make sure that you brush your teeth every morning and night. You will dress yourself. I don't have time to put dresses on every girl." Opening a drawer in Jane's dresser, she said, "Make your bed neatly every morning and put away your clothes. Don't leave anything on the floor. We don't want anyone tripping over shoes or a piece of clothing that you're too lazy to pick up." Jane watched the woman and wondered why she was looking in her drawer. "I see that you have folded your blouses very neatly. I think that you must be a very tidy girl. Always be tidy. It will help you to find things because they will always be where they should be. None of this throwing clothing into a drawer and slamming it shut business. When you're walking in the hall or going down the stairs, always stay to the right," she continued. "That way you won't run into another student. You will find the dining room, classroom, and playrooms by yourself. Can you see at all?" Overwhelmed, Jane nodded weakly. Miss Black crossed the room and stood by the door. "Well, I don't know how much you can see, but if you get lost, you can ask another girl. Just don't ask a boy. Boys and girls are not allowed to talk to each other. Any questions?" She turned to leave, her hand on the doorknob. "No, Miss Black. Well, I'll be watching you. If you follow the rules, you'll be just fine." The door shut behind her, leaving Jane alone once again. Stunned, Jane fought back tears. Another wave of homesickness struck her as she thought about her mother and her loving hugs. Miss Black wasn't going to comfort her. Marie was a friend who commiserated with her, but it was clear that she would have to make it on her own. She had no other choice. It took Jane a couple of days to become familiar with the layout of the school. She listened for the sound of shoes tapping down steps and knew that the stairs were close by. Walking down the halls, she ran her right hand along the rough plaster walls. When her hand hit air, that indicated an open door. If her hand felt wood, the door was closed. She counted the number of doors until she knew how many she needed to pass before reaching her destination. To find the bathroom, she turned right from her room and counted two doors. The third door was their communal bath. Jane adapted easily to indoor plumbing and never missed the outhouse at home. Baths were allowed on Saturdays. Jane enjoyed the warm water and the heated bathrooms. She was used to bathing in a tin tub in the chilly kitchen of her farmhouse. With no running water, Bessie would pump buckets full of cold water at the well and heat it on the wood stove. By the time it was Jane's turn to get into the tub, the water was chilly and dirty. Here, the baths at school were luxurious with warm water right out of the faucet. Only a few students were completely blind. Most had low vision and could read fairly well, although they were not able to see well enough to attend public schools. Jane could still read and write letters when she first arrived at Indianapolis. Telephones were not common in the mid-1920s, so the only way for people to communicate was by letter. Getting a letter from home was always an exciting event. When the mail arrived, those with some vision read the letters out loud to the recipients. Of course, there was no privacy in that system. Children who didn't get letters hung around and listened to another family's news. It was better than nothing for those unlucky ones. At the beginning of the school year, Jane was placed in the third grade. Her favorite part of the day was when the teacher, Miss Jenkins, read books such as The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn and Raggedy Ann to the class, which helped to inspire a lifelong love of literature. While listening to stories engaged her imagination, Jane's world expanded greatly when she learned Braille. Sitting in a small table equipped with a pegboard, she made Braille letters and numbers by putting pegs into the holes. Each letter and number have a distinctive pattern, and she practiced all 36 patterns. Once she could easily and quickly make every letter, she made simple words on the pegboard. "Jane, I think you're ready to start reading a Braille book," said Miss Jenkins, as she put a copy of Mother Goose Rhymes in her hands. "You've already started making and reading words on the pegboard. This will be easier than the pegboard. Please open the book and start reading to me on the first page." Jane tentatively put her fingers on the dots, feeling each one while moving her fingers to follow the dots along the page. "J-A-C-K," Jane spelled aloud. "Jack!" Jane's face lit up with the realization that her world was about to grow much larger and exciting. Soon she'd be able to read by herself and not have to depend upon others to read to her. "That's right, Jane. Very good. As you practice, you'll go faster, and you'll recognize words like and thee without thinking so hard. You'll be reading chapter books before you know it," encouraged Mrs. Jenkins. Jane reveled in the teacher's attention. She had been ignored so often in public school that she'd almost given up learning anything. She blossomed under the kind, patient instructor. No longer was she frustrated and humiliated in the classroom, unable to keep up with the sighted students at Lincolnville. School became fun for Jane, and she eagerly looked forward to class. While she was working at mastering reading, Jane learned how to write Braille using a slate and stylus. She opened the slate and inserted the special thick paper, thin paper made for the sloppy and illegible dots, and squeezed the two ends of the slate together. Now the paper was gripped tightly and wouldn't slip when she punched holes. Next, she held the stylus with the sharp end down and used the small cells within the slate to guide her hand as she punched the dots into the paper that became letters. Jane quickly learned how to read and write Braille, a skill she would use in school for taking notes and answering test questions. It enabled her to enjoy a lifetime of reading and made daily life easier by using Braille labels for clothes and canned food. After class one day, Jane and her friends walked down into the mailroom, hoping that a letter from home would be waiting. "Jane, here's a letter for you," said the woman behind the desk. "Thank you," she replied, holding out her hand. With the precious paper held tightly, Jane moved to the back and waited for her friends to learn if they would get an envelope. When the letters had been distributed, Jane said, "Can someone read this to me?" "I can. I didn't get anything today," Molly said sadly. "I'm sorry that you didn't get a letter. Maybe tomorrow you'll get one," said Jane, as she handed her own to Molly. "The return address says it's from Lincolnville," said Molly. "It must be from my mother. Please read it," pleaded Jane. "Dear Jane," Molly read, "I hope that you're well. We are fine here. Pop has been working out in the fields, and I've been doing a lot of sewing. Irma and Ruth have both gotten taller, and I've had to make new dresses for them. I imagine you're getting taller, too. You can try on some of Irma's clothes when you come home. If they don't fit, I'll make you something over Thanksgiving. I'm glad that you liked learning Braille. I want to learn how to read and write it, too. Then I can write you letters, and you won't have to find someone to read my letters to you. Won't that be wonderful? Well, it's time to feed the chickens. I'll write again soon. Love, Mother." "Oh, I can't wait until Mom learns how to write Braille. Then I can read and reread her letters whenever I want. But it takes a long time to learn Braille. Oh, well, maybe she'll be faster than me. Thanks, Molly, for reading my letter to me." The excitement of learning Braille didn't stop the days from passing slowly that fall. Even though Jane was happy to be learning new skills, she was still very homesick. Weekends were especially difficult. Many children went home, but the farm was too far away and train tickets too expensive for Jane to go home. Her best friend, Marie, became so homesick that her parents came to school and took her home permanently. Jane was devastated. Now who would be her friend? Who else could understand her homesickness? Jane wrote letters and begged her parents to come and get her, but they never did. Finally, it was November, and Thanksgiving was near. Charles took the train from Wabash to Indianapolis and brought her back for a short vacation at home. Jane was happy to be back with her family again, reveling in their attention. Everyone wanted to know what it was like at the school. Jane talked excitedly about her roommates, her nice teacher, and learning Braille. After months of bland institutional cooking, Thanksgiving dinner tasted especially good. Yet, from the moment she arrived home, Jane dreaded the return to school. She kept busy chatting and playing with her sisters, willing herself not to think about leaving home again. All too soon, it was time to leave for the station. "Mom, I don't want to go back to school," Jane said as tears slid down her cheeks. "I know I need to go, but I miss you so much. Now that Marie isn't coming back, I don't even have a best friend." "Now, Jane, quit your crying. You'll be just fine. You made it to Thanksgiving, and it's only about 3 more weeks until you'll be back for Christmas," said Bessie, handing her a cotton handkerchief. Not wanting to talk back to her mother, but feeling misunderstood, 3 weeks was a long time. Jane fought to hold back the tears. Yet the harder she tried, the louder she sobbed. Bessie gave her a long bear hug and said, "I love you. You've grown up so much since September, and I know you'll be fine. Now it's time for you to go with Pop to the station." She gave Jane a final squeeze and helped her put on her heavy winter coat. "Write lots of letters, Mom. And Ruth and Irma, send me letters too. I need lots of mail," Jane called as she turned to walk out the door. In early January 1924, her teacher, Miss Jenkins, asked Jane to stop at her desk after class. "Jane, you have learned Braille very quickly. You know too much for this class. I think it's time for you to move up to 4th grade. "But I'm not sure that I'm ready to move up," Jane blurted out. She was stunned that she'd have to meet other students and get used to a new teacher so soon after entering the school. Learning her way around another classroom was yet another adjustment that frightened Jane. "Don't worry, Jane. I know that you can handle the work. You will start 4th grade with Miss Stevens on Monday." After spending the weekend worrying about her new teacher, would she be as nice as Miss Jenkins? And how hard 4th grade might be, Jane walked through the crowded hall, past her old classroom, to her new room. Miss Stevens was waiting for her. "Hello, Ella Jane. Welcome to 4th grade. Your seat is on the left side. Can you see the empty desk?" Jane squinted and nodded. Still cringing from hearing her full name, she always hated that name, Ella, and much preferred to be called Jane. She resolved to tell Miss Stevens after class. She was afraid that her new classmates would call her Ella Jane. That would be not a good way to begin 4th grade. Heart pounding, Jane slowly made her way to her new desk. Even with little vision, she could feel all eyes of the other students upon her. A new girl in the class was a big event, and everyone in the 4th grade was curious about her. Across the aisle from Jane sat a tall, thin boy named Mario Peroni, a quiet and studious child. He was also curious about the new girl. Mario had no vision, but relied upon his acute hearing to help him learn about her, listening closely when Jane answered a question. Her answers were thoughtful and intelligent. It didn't take long for him to decide that he liked the sound of her voice. On a cold February morning, Jane waited to recite her memorized poem. Some children sputtered and couldn't remember the lines. Jane's heart beat faster as she listened. "Jane, please stand and recite your verse," said Miss Stevens. Trembling, Jane rose out of her chair and stood beside her desk. She was so close to Mario that he could have reached out and touched her. But, of course, he obeyed the rules. He listened with rapt attention as her wavering voice spoke the lines. "Today, Thomas Carlyle. So here hath been dawning another blue day. Think wilt thou let it slip useless away? Out of eternity, this new day is born into eternity. At night, will return." The moment she finished, Jane dropped into her chair and heaved a sigh of relief. She hated reciting in front of the class and was glad the ordeal was over. Little did she realize the effect the sound of her voice had on the boy across the aisle. Mario listened intently and memorized the poem as she recited the lines, later replaying her words countless times in his head as her voice echoed in his ears. He wished that he could congratulate her on her achievement, but the rules in 1925 against interactions between the sexes were unbending. He didn't want to get in trouble with the teacher if he talked to Jane, but the rules didn't stop him from thinking about her. Chapter 5. The End of Sight. Shortly after Jane arrived at the school, the assistant governess insisted that Jane see the eye doctor, who came monthly to examine students. The woman hoped that Dr. Morrison could do something to stop the glaucoma, but Jane did not expect a miracle. She knew that there was no cure. "The examination was short," the doctor sat back and said. "There's nothing that I can do. I'm sorry, Ella Jane." "Yes, sir. Thank you, Dr. Morrison," said Jane. Even though she was only 10 years old, she had become used to the idea of one day becoming totally blind and was not surprised that the doctor couldn't help her. She had expected that the visit would be a waste of time. Her family doctor had said that when she was born, there was no cure, and for her parents not to waste their money searching for one. At least, now the governess seemed assured that nothing could be done, and Jane would not be subjected to any further eye examinations. Jane's vision continued to decline. She didn't want to complain about her constant headaches. She would be sent up to the third floor, where sick children were taken, to little rooms with nothing to do and no one to keep her company. The threat of being alone in the claustrophobic rooms was enough to keep her silent. Jane's dorm room overlooked busy Meriden Street in downtown Indianapolis. Outside her window was a tall neon sign that seemed 3 stories high. She couldn't see the letters of what it advertised, but she loved to lie in bed at night and watch as it changed colors. It flashed a bright white light, then red, then green. The sign went dark, but a second or two later came on again, repeating the cycle. The colors were pretty and helped her relax to fall asleep. One clear night in April, Jane lay in her bed, watching the lights. With a start, she realized that she couldn't see the red or the green flashes. She could see the blur of the white light, but not the colors. It was the last time she remembered seeing anything. She wasn't sad to lose her sight. She just gave up. The next morning, she told Miss Black that she couldn't see. The governess didn't give any comfort to the girl, nor treat her differently. Jane told herself that it really didn't matter, so she got dressed and went to school. She was 11 years old. Chapter 6. Mario. It was a damp and foggy day, the day Mario was born in January 1914. The Muncie Evening Press reported, "The atmosphere was comparatively mild but very heavy. Physicians warned the public that the weather in Muncie, Indiana, was very unhealthy, and there are more cases of coughs, colds, and grip in the city than there have been for a long time. But Aletta Peroni wasn't worried about the weather or catching a cold. She was lying in bed, holding her newborn son. Her smile faded as she stared at his eyes. "Antonio," she said to her husband, "look at his eyes. They're too big." "What? There's nothing wrong with his eyes," he said, peering over Aletta's arms for a better look at the baby's face. "He's just crying hard. His eyes are fine." Aletta knew that Antonio was placating her. He couldn't help but notice that their baby's eyes were grossly enlarged, and while she understood that Antonio didn't want to be upset after her giving birth to their second child, she knew something was terribly wrong. Aletta looked at the doctor who had delivered her son. He shrugged and admitted, "I don't know if there's a problem. Maybe the swelling will go down. Let's just wait and see. But right now, I can't do anything for his eyes. I'm sorry." Months later, another doctor diagnosed Mario with congenital glaucoma. The doctor explained that there was too much pressure in the baby's eyes, which damaged both optic nerves. Although he still had some vision, there was no treatment. One day, their child would be totally blind. Stunned by the prognosis, Italian immigrants Aletta and Antonio worried about how they would raise a blind child. They would have to watch him constantly to ensure that he didn't hurt himself. Aletta, who spoke limited English, was already busy with 3-year-old Charles and running the household. Antonio worked 12-hour days at his downtown confectionery store, making and selling ice cream and candy. The store made enough money to support his family, but they lived simply and had no luxuries. The additional stress of coping with Mario's blindness and the expense of extra doctor visits added to the tension for both parents. Besides trying to keep him safe, Aletta wondered if he could be educated. A blind child couldn't read or write. As faithful Catholics, both parents assumed that their children would attend the neighborhood parochial school, St. Lawrence. But now their baby would never be able to go to school. Aletta visualized a future where all Mario could do was sit all day and wait for someone to entertain him. The picture terrified her. Aletta and Antonio had many conversations about Mario's future. Antonio was worried that Mario would be financially dependent upon him. Nobody would hire a blind man. What would happen to Mario when they died? Where would he live? Who would take care of him? Yet Aletta did not want to give up hope for a cure. Both Aletta and Antonio were devout Catholics and attended daily Mass. At home, they prayed at their shrine to the Virgin Mary for a miracle. In letters back to Italy, Aletta enlisted all of her family members to pray for Mario's healing. She was certain that God would answer her prayers. The wood-framed family home was built south of downtown, across the street from busy railroad tracks. Coal was used to heat most buildings in 1917, and coal trains frequently traveled through Muncie on their way to Chicago. The steam's engine whistle alerted 3-year-old Mario that a train was coming. He rushed to the porch and, even in the coldest weather, stood to watch the train's arrival just a couple of hundred yards away. The coal cars, loaded so that the coal was higher in the middle, were often topped with snow. Squinting his eyes, Mario could see the contrast between the black coal and the white snow, thrilling him with the excitement of seeing the train and hearing the clacking of the wheels as it roared down the tracks. Mario loved everything that moved, trains, the interurban, cars, and noisy trucks. He'd never been on a train or interurban and liked to imagine what it would be like to ride on one. What would it feel like to go so fast? How loud would the whistle be? The train whistles from across the street were loud enough to hurt his ears. He wondered how loud it would be if he was riding inside the car. Early on a summer morning, when Mario was 3 and a half, Aletta said to him, "Mario, we're going to take the Interurban to Indianapolis today." Mario stopped playing with Charles, whom he called Charlie's wood blocks, and jumped up to hug his mother. "Really? I can't wait. I've always wanted to go for a ride on the Interurban. Today, you are going to see a special eye doctor. Dad and I think that he can help you." The prospect of riding on the Interurban with his parents was exciting, almost making up for the pain he knew he'd experience when the doctor probed his eyes. Hoping for a miracle, the family boarded the Interurban in Muncie and began their hour-long ride to the capital city. Mario sat on his knees with his hands on the window to balance him. He smiled as he felt the air blow through the window, buffeting his face and mussing his hair. He could only see blurry shapes as the Interurban passed farms and barns, but he was enthralled with the constantly changing shapes and colors. The time passed quickly, and Mario was surprised when the rail car came to a stop at the station in downtown Indianapolis. "Mario, we're here. We must get off now. Here, take my hand," said Aletta. "But, Mom, I want to keep going. I love the Interurban." "Remember that we'll ride it again after we see the doctor. That ride will be even better, because then we'll be home again," said Aletta. After examining the young child, the doctor turned to Aletta and Antonio and said the words they wanted to hear. "I think I can help Mario. I can do a surgical procedure which should relieve the pressure on his optic nerves. If the pressure is gone, then I think that he could regain some of his sight." They readily agreed and with much hope arranged to have the surgery performed the following month. But the surgery was botched. What limited vision Mario had before the operation was gone. He left with nominal light perception. He could tell if the sun was out, but he couldn't actually see the sun. Now he could only hear the coal trains as their wheels clacked rhythmically on the tracks by his home. Mario cried and whimpered in pain for days after the surgery. He'd never forget the agony and never forgave the surgeon for taking away what was left of his vision. Mario wished that his parents would give up their search for a cure. He didn't mind being blind. He was happy playing with Charlie, who included him in games with his friends and taught him the names of the neighborhood streets. Mario would grow to memorize the name and direction of almost every street in Muncie, and as a child was proud to be able to walk alone without getting lost. Aletta, perhaps feeling guilty about the failed surgery and becoming more desperate for a cure, took Mario to still more doctors. The only thing they could do was give him eye drops, which stung his tender eyes. Mario squirmed and tried to resist the eye drops, but was held down and forced to endure the pain. The drops did nothing to improve his sight. As Mario's right eye swelled with the mounting pressure, the pain increased. It was especially agonizing at night when his mother would hold him softly and sing Italian folk songs. While it soothed him, it didn't stop the pain. Lying in bed in the room that he shared with his 7-year-old brother, Mario often distracted himself by listening to the trains as they passed. "Charlie, where do you think that train is going? What's in those big box cars?" "Mario, how do you know they're box cars?" "Oh, by the sound. Can't you tell the difference between a box car and a coal car?" "No, I don't know how you do it." Charlie peered out the window. "Mario, you're right. They're all box cars. Maybe they're going to Minneapolis or somewhere in Canada." "Ooh, that would be exciting. Wouldn't it be fun to ride on a freight train just to see where we'd end up?" "I'd rather go on a nice passenger train. Let's go to sleep," said Charlie. Mario tried to get comfortable under the blankets, but his eye hurt no matter if he lay on his back or on his side. He could tell by the sound of Charlie's breathing that he was already asleep and wished his eye would allow him to sleep. Mario quietly counted the chimes of the living room clock as it rang 11 times, while trying to imagine himself as the engineer driving a huge steam engine. Mario finally fell into a troubled sleep. But late one night, when Mario was almost 5, he couldn't keep the pain away by listening to trains or fantasizing about driving a big train engine. It became unbearable. He abruptly sat up in bed and touched his right eye just as it exploded. He was horrified to feel the moist bits of his eye sliding down his cheek. He screamed in terror. Charlie woke up and tried not to vomit as he yelled, "Mom! Dad! Mario's eye burst!" Mario felt Charlie's shaking hands grab his. "Mario, don't touch your eye!" Mario, feeling nauseated himself, didn't fight his brother. Aletta and Antonio rushed into the room and turned on the light. "Dio mio! My God!" He heard his mother gasp and felt her handkerchief gently wipe his face. She pulled another handkerchief out of her pocket and held it softly against his eye, then sat down on his bed and enfolded him in her safe arms. Trembling and moaning, Mario heard his mother and father's voices arguing about calling a doctor. But what could a doctor do? His father said that no medicine could help a burst eyeball. His mother sighed and softly began praying in Italian. Comforted by his mother's prayers, Mario calmed and began to relax. Suddenly, he realized he had no more pain. "Mama," he said, "my eye doesn't hurt anymore." She squeezed his hand. "Oh, Mario, thank you, God, for that blessing." Mother and son held each other tightly until the 4-year-old fell asleep at last. The pain was gone, but so was his eye. Months later, Aletta took him on a train to Cincinnati, hoping to find a doctor that could cure his remaining eye. Again, she was unsuccessful. Just the thought of her son being totally blind for life was enough to keep her hoping and searching for someone, anyone, who could help. Prayer helped her get her through the day, but so far hadn't produced the longed-for miracle. There was one other possibility of hope. An Italian faith healer who lived in the mountains not far from her home village of San Pietro. Perhaps she would be the one to cure her son. Chapter 7. Italy. By 1919, the First World War was over, and it was finally safe to travel to Europe. Aletta was anxious to return to Italy. She'd been away from her family for over 9 years and wanted her sons to meet her Italian relatives. Even more importantly, she still hoped to find someone to cure Mario's glaucoma. Aletta continued to pray for a miracle and thought that if no one in America could help, surely Italy would have the right doctor. Mario was 5 and Charlie 8 when they began their journey to San Pietro in Campo. In preparation for the trip, Aletta had taken a map of the United States and shown Mario the train's route. She had gently taken his fingers and traced the route on the map from Muncie to Cleveland, then northeast to Buffalo, east to Albany, and south along the Hudson River to New York City. Mario wanted to know the names of all the cities and towns along the route, along with questions about rivers and mountains that they would pass. "Mom, I understand how we'll get to New York, but where is Italy? How long will it take to cross the ocean? How big is the ocean?" asked Mario. "Mario, so many questions. The ocean is very big. It will take us about 10 days to cross it. Italy is on the other side of the ocean." "How does the ship know where to go? If the ocean is so big, won't it get lost?" Aletta smiled. "The ship has a captain. He knows how to steer the ship using a compass. I know what that is. It shows which direction you're going. But where is Italy? The ocean is very big, isn't it? Could you show me on a map like you did for the train? We don't have a map of the ocean. Maybe we should go to the library. They have a globe and I can show you the ocean. I'll put your fingers on New York and then you can feel how big the ocean is to Italy. I can even show you where we'll get off the ship in Genoa. Mom, I'd love to do that. Can we go right now? Plans were made for Aletta and the boys to travel via train to New York City, then board the steamship Re d'Italy for Genoa. Antonio was sorry that he couldn't travel with them. He couldn't leave the store for an extended period. In 1919, ladies don't travel alone or without a male escort. They would be accompanied by their husbands. And until World War I, U.S. passports were issued as Mr. Antonio Peroni and wife. Aletta had her own passport. Although she could legally travel alone with her children, societal rules insisted that she have a male escort for protection. Antonio's brother, Faust, agreed to accompany the family to New York City. Mario waited impatiently for Charlie's school to let out for the summer. Finally, on a warm, late June day, the family said a tearful goodbye to Antonio and boarded the train to Cleveland, where they would change trains for New York. While he could hardly wait to begin the trip, Mario's excitement was tempered by sadness that he wouldn't see his father again until the following summer. Antonio and Faust watched as the porter loaded the heavy trunk and suitcases into the baggage car. The steam whistle blew a warning signal, and the conductor called, "All aboard!" Faust climbed up the steps into the second-class car and sat on the cloth seat next to Charlie. The boys waved from the open window and then sat back as the train slowly chugged away from the station. The next day, they arrived in Cleveland, where they had a 4-hour layover. To pass the time, Aletta and Faust took the boys to a nearby park next to Lake Erie. Tired from running and throwing stones into the lake, Mario asked, "Uncle Faust, why do we have to wait so long?" "The next train to New York is only a first-class train. We don't have tickets for that one because it costs so much. We have to wait until the next train that has both first and second classes." "Oh, well, I wish it would hurry up. I want to get on the boat." After spending 2 days sitting upright on an increasingly uncomfortable train seat, they finally arrived in New York. Faust loaded their luggage into a taxi and directed the driver to the dock where the ship, the Re Italia, was berthed. The steamship had only first and third classes. The third class was in steerage, a dark and unpleasant way to cross the Atlantic. Aletta chose the extra expense of traveling first class to enjoy the fresh air and the better accommodations. When the captain noticed that she was traveling alone with two children, he invited the family to sit at the head table with him and his officers. Mario liked the extra attention from the staff, especially when the captain gave him chewing gum and candy. Compared to other ocean-going ships, the Re Italia was small, but it was huge to Mario. The boys spent most of their time at sea roaming the first-class decks, exploring every nook and cranny. Aletta warned them not to go down into steerage, so of course they were curious to see the forbidden zone. Late in the afternoon of the second day at sea, Charlie decided that it wouldn't hurt to sneak down the stairs and see what was happening in steerage. "Come on, Mario, let's go see what's down these steps." "But Mom said not to go down there," replied Mario. "We won't tell her, and besides, we'll be quick. I'll tell you what I see." Mario followed Charlie, both boys tiptoeing quietly as they descended into the darkness of the third-class deck. Charlie peered around the corner. "Mario," he whispered, "you won't believe this. There's a group of 5 men, and they're all eating out of the same big pot with their hands. They're pulling out big globs of spaghetti and eating it. They don't have any plates or forks." As his eyes got used to the dark, he realized that everyone in the dining hall was grabbing the pasta with their hands and eating it hungrily. "Let's get out of here," he said, and the boys ran back up the stairs, no longer worried about being quiet. With a new appreciation for their travel accommodations, they ran to the first-class dining room and joined their mother at the captain's table. During the 12-day journey, Mario learned to keep his balance as the ship pushed through the waves. He planted his feet wide apart while standing and reached for the handrails. He especially liked it when the wave lifted the ship up, then forced it down, smacking the water and making a huge splash. Sometimes water sprayed up onto his face, making him laugh with delight. Mario loved the motion of the ship and luckily never got seasick. The brothers made friends with the sailors, asking questions about their jobs and learning about the big steam engines that propelled the boat. Mario listened for the engine's rumble and often put his hands on a wall or railing to feel the vibrations. "Charlie, come here and put your hands next to mine. Feel the engines. They are so strong that they make the walls shake. I can tell when the captain makes the ship go faster. The engines get really loud, and sometimes I think that the ship will fall apart." A nearby sailor overheard Mario's concern and said, "Don't worry, boy. The ship's very strong. But you're right. When we crank her up, she gets pretty loud." "Well, I can't swim, so this ship had better not come apart and sink," replied Mario. The sailor smiled and said, "I've been on this ship for 5 years. She'll be afloat for a very long time." When he wasn't following Charlie on explorations, Mario liked relaxing in a deck chair, feeling the sun on his face and the wind whipping his hair. He breathed in the fresh air and tried to imagine the endless blue of the ocean. The squawk of a large seabird caught his attention. "Charlie, I think I just heard a bird. What's a bird doing out in the middle of the ocean?" "It's flying around." "Yes, but what happens when it gets tired? There aren't any trees. I thought that all birds lived in trees." "The bird just landed in the ocean. It's floating on the waves. Maybe it can sleep while it floats. Oh, it just dove under the water." "Why would it do that, Charlie?" "Maybe it's fishing. It must like fish. There's no dirt, so there aren't any worms like we have in Muncie. I miss the singing of the cardinals and robins at home. I love the sounds they make." "How big is this bird?" "A lot bigger than a cardinal. It's got really big wings. I think it could fly a long way." After almost 2,500 miles, the ship made its first stop in the Azores Island to refuel. Mario was fascinated by the idea of a speck of land in what felt like the middle of the huge Atlantic Ocean. He remembered that his mom had shown him the globe and put his fingers on the Azores. The islands had seemed very, very small compared to all that water around them. He wondered how the islands got there and what it would be like to live on an island. Where did the residents get their food? Mario knew about farms and wondered if the Azores had farms with corn or cows. After being confined for days on the ship, Mario and Charlie happily ran ahead of their mother on the walk into town. The stop was a short one, with only enough time to explore the town and have lunch. The Azores had been of great strategic importance during the war, when the United States had established a large naval base to aid Europe's defense. The Red Cross operated a restaurant and store to serve troops stationed on the islands. The restaurant was open to the public now, so the family had lunch and dessert there, savoring their first ice cream since leaving Muncie. Mario wished that he had more time to explore the island. He wanted answers to his questions, but neither his mother nor Charlie seemed to have them. Someday he'd learn to read, just like his brother. Then he would learn all about the islands in the world by himself. The next stop was Gibraltar, where the ship again refueled. The family disembarked and used the time to explore the Rock of Gibraltar and its famous limestone caves. Back outside in the bright sunlight, they went to the beach where Mario enjoyed the seagulls screeching and played chase with Charlie in the sand. All too soon, it was time to embark on the next leg of their journey to Naples. The ship docked in Naples in the early morning, 5 days later, which allowed the passengers a full day to tour. Aletta and a female friend she'd met on board decided that it would be enough time to take a side trip to Pompeii. The ancient city, destroyed by the eruption of Mount Vesuvius, was only 17 miles away, and Aletta thought it would be a good outing for the boys. After a full day of touring, they returned to the docks to find an empty spot where the Re d'Italia should have been. Mio Dio, Aletta muttered under her breath. The two women became very upset as they realized they had been left behind. Mario gripped his mother's hand tightly and struggled to understand what was going on. Mom, where's the ship? Asked Charlie. I don't know. Stay here. I'll go ask someone, she said, as she released Mario's hand and hurried off to a group of workers. Mario listened to the tapping of her footsteps grow softer. Where was she going? Where was the boat? What was happening? His heart began to race, and he reached for Charlie's hand. Moments later, he heard her speak in rapid-fire Italian and the equally fast replies from the men. Aletta came running toward them, panting and out of breath. Mario, Charles, come with me. We need to find a telegraph office quickly. I have to tell my brother that we missed the boat. Why, Mom, what's going on? Can't we just telephone him? Asked Charles. There are no telephones yet in Italy. The ship has left without us. I need to let Uncle Rocco know what happened, and the only way I can do that is by a telegram. Shortly after sending the message, the group found the train station and managed to get tickets on a train to Rome. Although their ultimate destination was Genoa, it was the only train available that evening. Aletta was frantic. She worried that her brother wouldn't get the telegram and arrive at the docks, only to wonder why they weren't on the ship. All their luggage was still aboard. The women only had their purses. Arriving in Rome after midnight with two tired children, the women began searching for a place to sleep. After wandering around the darkened streets of downtown Rome, they asked a gentleman passing by if he could recommend a hotel. He gave them directions to a nearby rooming house. The women were quite relieved when the owner opened the door and said that he had one room available. After Aletta checked for bedbugs, all four of them piled onto the one bed and quickly fell asleep. Early the next morning, still wearing the same clothes from the day before, the weary group boarded the train to Genoa. We have come to the end of the book hour and today's reading of The Sound of Her Voice by Mary Harper. The preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio. While Mario enjoyed the ride, Aletta was anxiously looking at her watch, willing the train to go faster. When they finally pulled into the Genoa station, Aletta heaved a sigh of relief. While disembarking, Aletta said goodbye to her friend and heard her older brother calling her name. "He's here! Come, children, let's go meet your Uncle Rocco," she said as she steered the boys toward the priest. The brother and sister hugged and kissed each other on both cheeks, speaking Italian so fast that Mario couldn't understand their words, but he could tell that his mother was very happy to see her older brother, and suddenly her mood felt lighter. Mario, too, began to relax. Rocco bent down and solemnly shook each boy's hand. Suddenly laughing, he gave each a big hug, saying how pleased he was to meet them. We have come to the end of the book hour and today's reading of The Sound of Her Voice by Mary Harper. The preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.